All right, Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure.
Very pleased to be here.
Yeah, so it's very exciting. You mentioned on DM that you hadn't done a podcast before. When I said, have you got any podcasts, you said me. So this is the first one. You're going to absolutely smash it. Don't worry in the slightest. And if anything, I'm just very lucky to get to hear your story first in what is the kind of Nostr and Bitcoin space. And with that, I'd love to start with Nostr. So we have been following each other for a while and, liking some things, zapping some things. And I recently put out a message a couple of days ago asking for people to recommend from the audience who they'd like to have on. And you were one of the recommendations. Awesome. So here we are. So why are you using Nostr, Mike?
Oof. Okay. So let's go principle first. Nostr mm-hmm. follows all the Bitcoin principles. So the freedom, trustless, permissionless, just absolutely, there's no question to use anything else really, or to be able to rely on anything else. I got into it because of Jack Dorsey. So I was on Twitter, X, and he posts quite cryptically. So I think he posted his public key a couple of times, and I recognized it as a public key, but it was no public key I'd ever seen before. It wasn't a Bitcoin address, wasn't a PGP address, didn't say anything else. I did that a couple of times and then posted the word Nostr. Okay, that's interesting. I think the rule in advertising is you have to see something seven times before you buy. And I think the seventh time was Ben Perrin, BTC Sessions, posted a video saying, okay, I'm gonna set up Nostr. So I watched it and it was awful. So it looked awful. It was unbelievably difficult to use. This is a very early client, you know, nothing worked. It looked terrible, but I saw the potential. I thought, okay, so you're running your own social media. It's not an account. It's a public key pair. You're in control. It's your data. You choose. It's permissionless, sensorless, you know, freedom. And I thought, okay, so I started it again, and I actually went through, I can't remember the name of the client, but it was an awful web-based thing. Set up my key pair. It was empty, and I had no followers. This was very early days. And so I thought, right, let's try and find Ben's NPub, or, you know, how to find him. I found him, then found who he was following and started going through that. And so there wasn't much to do back then. There was very little going on, but and obviously Nostr is very Bitcoin focused, but just the whole atmosphere of Nostr was very positive, very, it's a good vibe. You know, it's not like other social media platforms have kind of just got very hostile and very antagonistic and aggressive and defensive. And Nostr was just a very positive community, very Bitcoin focused. And I spend my whole life on Bitcoin. So I'm thinking about understanding and doing Bitcoin all the time. And so it was just very focused on where I wanted to be, had the right kind of community, and very inclusive, very positive, and as kind of grew as it grew and enjoyed being and just embraced the ecosystem. So I've enjoyed kind of, I now run my own relay, I've got my own NIP, my own identity, I've got my own, you know, my Lightning address is my own domain, and I just kind of enjoyed building out the whole self-sovereignty, I guess. Again, it embraces that idea of I am my own bank, I am my own identity, and I am my own communication system. I don't need to use or trust any third party for my money, for my identity, or to communicate on my behalf. So I very much enjoy that freedom.
It's so cool, isn't it? And it's interesting how information spreads. And someone like Jack Dorsey is extraordinarily influential, yet like cryptic. You had to like dig into it and find out like, what the hell is this guy trying to say? And so when you say like the early days of Nostr, roughly when are you referring to?
Oof. So I know it was around a year or so before I saw it, but I honestly can't remember. It's maybe 3 years ago, something like that. You can probably find out from my NPub. I don't know if it probably has a creation date.
I was about to check mine as well. Well, it's interesting that you talk about the early days, but to me, like, these are the early days of Noster. I mean, it's probably not even 5 years old. And to my understanding, mm-hmm. it came out of a hackathon that Ben Ark was part of, you know, these lightning developers that were looking at digital marketplaces that are decentralized. How do you actually mm-hmm. do it? And it completely caught my attention as well, in that very, very focused on, well, not necessarily focused on, but very aware of digital censorship. Okay, cool. So I was really talking about the route to Noster and the fact that information travels unfairly, and you have to, like, someone like a Jack Dorsey, you can follow their content, but even then it's kind of cryptic, and you're like, oh, what does he mean by this? But when you're mm-hmm. already into Bitcoin, the use case for Noster is very, very clear. And in particular, the last 5 years, when digital censorship has been so rampant on the legacy media platforms, it's like, well, we need some way of talking to each other online where you can't just get rug pulled. You know, the amount of YouTube channels I've seen canceled, or X accounts that get suspended, Instagram, you know, these people spend their lives building an account to suddenly, you know, it's not yours. You're building on someone else's digital fiefdom. And Noster is just so different. And mm-hmm. I'd love to then dive into some of those mm-hmm. things that you mentioned. So when you say you're running your own relay, let's start there first. What does that mean?
Yeah, the parallels between Noster and Bitcoin, you know, the freedom, the inability to censor. And I think the idea of being banked in the world, which being banked with Bitcoin, is between sort of centralized social media and Noster. It's the same thing. You can't be, so remediated on Noster. Of course, that has its own issues in terms of sort of liabilities and the sort of responsibility, who's legally liable for the transmission. So there has been this discussion, you know, if you run a relay and you inadvertently carry illegal content in your country, what are the ramifications of that? But that's always, those discussions have happened in Bitcoin as well. And, you know, we've had plenty of people arrested for being illegal money transmitters. You're always going to have those arguments, but I tend to be on the side of freedom over control. And I kind of realized I was kind of a Bitcoiner, although I got late into Bitcoin, or relatively late in terms of 2016-ish, I kind of realized I've been a Bitcoiner my whole life, because the idea of self-sovereignty, the idea of freedom, the idea of doing something without expecting to ask permission to do it, you know, these are all kind of native in my DNA. And I realized that, so when I sort of really started to understand Bitcoin, it was, okay, I don't need permission. Nobody can tell me what to do. And Noster's the same. If you don't like me, you don't listen to me, you know, and if I don't like you, I don't listen to you. If you're trolling me, I can mute you. So, you know, you have those personal controls, but you take personal responsibility for what you want to see, what you don't want to see, what you want to say, what you don't want to say. And there's no state or authority or company making decisions on your behalf. And as I go down this journey, I realize that's more and more my DNA. And I very much sort of, I guess it's emphasizing that DNA, that part of my DNA, and the fact that I do value that. We've just put our house on the market, or we're just about to list our house, because we're looking to leave the UK. Haven't sold a house for a while in the UK. And suddenly the estate agent was telling us all these things we had to do. Like, we have to tell them, you know, what our council tax band is, and we have to tell them what our rateable. And it's like, no, I'm paying you. You don't tell me what to do. If you're selling my house and I'm paying you quite a lot of money to sell my house, or I appreciate that the buyer does, this concept that the estate agent now, because of the government, and it's not the estate agent's fault, it is the government requiring the estate agent to do KYC, AML, but also we have to prove we own the house, we have to prove the thing we say about the house. And I'm used to doing that when we've actually sold the property, you know, to a solicitor. You have to prove everything you say to the buyer, but just marketing it, I now have to prove everything just to sell it. And it's like, okay, why? And so he turned up and he said, I've got to take a photo of your driving license and passport. I said, but you're turning up to my house. This is my house, and you want to take a picture of my passport and my driving license. And so, he was taken aback because I seriously said, okay, that's fine, but where's yours? I want your driving license. I want your passport. I want your company's certificate of incorporation. I want your, I want to know who you are, because you're a stranger. You're turning up to my house and you want me to verify who I am. And I think he was a little bit taken aback. So, my ambition is to sell the house for Bitcoin, and we haven't got that far yet. We're still discussing the concept of freedom. And cool. I'm not even entirely certain whether he'll stick with me on the journey, but I'm trying to orange pill my estate agent. In terms of Bitcoin, just in terms of freedom. That concept of freedom that is gradually being removed in society, and certainly in the Western world, and certainly in the UK, this idea that you know, you have to know every nth detail and prove every nth detail to do anything is getting too oppressive. And Bitcoin solves the financial side of that. Nostr solves the identity. You know, I'm very big on, my identity is not my government issued passport or driving license. My identity is my NIP05. It's my self-verified public key that I store on my own server, on my own website, that says I am who I say I am. And if I say I'm who I say I am, who's anybody else to disagree with me?
Well, and also the social graph that Nostr is building shows a lot of truth, because you've got all these connections and you've interacted with them in the past. And so it's almost like I don't want to call it a treasure map, because that implies like you're lost, but it's a ledger in a way of previous communication. It's like, this guy is very likely to be who he says he is, given also all this other kind of digital breadcrumbs that you can pull together. Mike, why do you want to leave the UK?
Why do I want to leave the UK? So it started off tax, obviously. So I've never sold any Bitcoin, but I've obviously made significant gains. And the government that was coming in was about to put up capital gains from 20, and it was rumored it was going to go up to 40%+. In the end, it went from 20 to 24%. And that was fine because I haven't made any capital gains. But then I discovered, if you want to leave the UK tax system, you have to pay capital gains on unrealized assets, which means the increase in value. So I've got other properties. So you can make profit on your main property, but other properties, you have to pay capital gains tax on those, and stocks and shares, and most significantly, Bitcoin. So I would have to pay, I'd have to give 20, near enough 25% of all my Bitcoin to the government to leave the UK. And it's like, okay, that's not happening. So
yeah.
I now find that I'm not going to leave. My plan at the moment is to not leave the UK tax system, but to leave the UK, which means I can take profit and keep profit abroad and never bring it back to the UK, which means I don't have to pay tax on it. But that started off as the sort of initiator was this creep of taxation. And inflation, and just the whole economic system, not just the UK, you know, not of the world. But there's other reasons as well. There were, you know, the threat of World War III and Britain's involvement in escalation of potential World War III. Now that's kind of, I think that's kind of died down. The three elements of that have kind of all subsided a little bit. Part of it is Bitcoin friendliness. The UK is not very Bitcoin friendly, certainly from a government point of view. And there's some very friendly Bitcoin countries, Malta or St. Kitts and Nevis and places like that, which are very Bitcoin friendly. Weather. It's nice to have, you know, be nice to be out of the UK. I mean, summers in the UK are beautiful, but this winter in particular has been not so great. And so it's kind of those things, really. Better winter weather, idea of self-sovereignty and freedom, and that you can just do, you don't need permission to do something. That sort of waking up, that kind of orange pill, that sort of Matrix reference of, you know, they're not asleep and just letting things happen. They're awake and sort of understanding what's going on, and that sort of heightened level of knowledge of the world. So understanding of the world and how it's going. Generally, Bitcoiners are more informed about the world than no-coiners. And Nost is another level of a game. So there's just a general quality of community amongst Bitcoiners. The freedom to be who I am in public, day to day, not just online like this. I mean, I'm me online, but I'm rarely me in real life with my normie friends. So I find myself fairly detached from my normie friends and family these days. I can't really have proper discussions with them. I can't sort of, because I want to tell them what the world's really like and they don't know. And it's difficult to sort of bridge that gap. So, yeah. There is another part of me that wants to stay and potentially help the UK. So there's a guy, Peter McCormack, in trying to transform Bedford. We have a holiday home on the Isle of Wight in Ventnor, which is both, like most seaside places, it's both poor and wealthy, but it is actually quite a poor place. And so part of me thinks I'd like to turn the Isle of Wight into a Bitcoin circular economy. So a bit like BTC Isla. So Isla Mares, she's creating a Bitcoin island. So part of me wants to stay and fight. Part of me wants to leave and relax. And I haven't decided exactly what I want to do yet. But getting rid of the sort of main properties, and so I've got the freedom to decide what I want to do, stay or fight or leave and have fun.
Your optionality improves hugely when Bitcoin grows as your wealth stack, i.e. the more Bitcoin you own as a percentage of everything else, the more your optionality increases. It's one of the financial benefits of adopting it. You know, it's like, right, well, I can leave tomorrow if you want. And it's so interesting what you say about the tax regimes, where you might live somewhere your whole life, and if you wanted to become non-tax resident, they've changed the rules such that they literally look at it like a capital disposal. So, oh, you've lived here for 30 years. Mm-hmm. All the stuff you own has gone up by this much. If you're going to leave, then you owe us tax, even if you don't sell it. It's like, what do you mean? And I have seen nifty workarounds where people use things like a trust, and you can potentially put assets in a trust, and then you can have an executive director of that trust still in the UK, and you could be somewhere else. Well, that works in Australia too, but you still have to get stuff into the trust. And the asset transfer in counts as a disposal on your personal account into this other legal vehicle. So I guess really what it comes down to is opportunity cost. It's like, if you do take that 25% hit now, but you never pay cap gains again on your Bitcoin, is that actually a good bet or not? And I don't know the answer, right? We don't know if they're going to suddenly drop cap gains in the UK next year, or if, you know, but I'm intrigued. So there's...
Well, the so what's interesting, the realization I had is 25% of Bitcoin is 25% of your Bitcoin at any price. So it actually doesn't matter. The price of Bitcoin doesn't matter, if that makes sense. So because 25% is 25%. It's 25% of my Bitcoin holding irrelevant of the price. Okay, so the rest of it matters. So the property prices and shares and things like that. I can leave that in the UK. That's not a problem. But I need a little bit of money to live on. So the gamble I'm taking is that they won't put up capital gain tax. So because I've never sold any Bitcoin, so I have no tax to pay. And if I just take a little bit of profit, but keep my holding, then I just pay tax on my living costs. But the hit is, so for the moment, leaving the UK, but not leaving the UK tax system is the best option. Okay. But if they were to raise the tax level of unrealized capital gains, then I would, then my gamble is not paid off. But if they keep it the same or not too much higher, then I'm okay. So in other words, do I leave now at 20 and I just, so if I leave the UK tax system and just relinquish 25% of all my profit and leave, then I have nothing to pay ever again, but I've got rid of 25%. I can leave now and effectively pay nothing because I've made no capital gains. I don't have to pay on those gains abroad. But if I want to, I do want to keep connection to the UK, so I can come back for 90 days a year or 91 days a year. And I do intend to, you know, summer's here in Iceland. So we intend to keep a place here and stay here. And any money that I, any capital gains that I cash in, so realized capital gains I have to pay on. So I can, that for the moment, that's the best option. But if they raise capital gains tax percentage again, then I may be forced to stay abroad and never come back. But then if they say, okay, you've been abroad, you now have to pay, you now have to leave, we're going to take, and it might be at that stage 40%. You know, I don't want to end up like Roger Ver, where they come after him 10 years later and just take money that he made in the future. So, it's quite complicated. But the gamble I've decided to take is to leave the UK, but not leave the UK tax system.
Yeah, okay. Cool. So in a way then, Mike, it's like instead of selling 25% of everything, you actually don't sell any, you leave, and let's say you're trimming your position 1%, 2%, 3%, the amount you actually crystallize, then you owe 25% of that crystallized amount. So it's a fraction of what would be a full 25% hit.
Yeah. So if I, while I'm in the UK, if I sell assets and make a profit, I pay 25% or 24% on that, the UK asset that I've sold. But I don't pay 25% of the assets abroad. So providing most of my wealth is abroad and stays abroad, I don't have to pay tax on that. It's only profit I take in the UK.
Okay.
That's the gamble I'm taking.
And it's so, I mean, even having this conversation, it's complicated. And it's annoying how complicated like these tax systems have become. They're just massive. You talk about freedom, right? Get paid on your you get taxed on your income, taxed on your death, taxed when you sell stuff, taxed when you buy stuff. I mean, just the list goes on. So I'm intrigued, Mike, to rewind a little. We've obviously met on Noster and are bullish on Bitcoin and bullish on Noster, which are new technologies. But what have you done throughout your career that helped you see the value in Bitcoin and helped you see the value in Noster?
Season is just, I got straight away and realized I was a rubbish electronics engineer, but I really like computers. And then in 1989, I saw the internet and I thought, holy cow, this is amazing. I was actually at a college. We were on a Primus computer, which is a very old mini computer in the computer lab of the local college. And they told us to do something called Telnet to what was it, alpha.mit.edu. And I typed that in, and suddenly I got to a prompt of a DEC computer, which I was familiar with. So I understood DEC computers. And I thought, oh, this is another computer they've got on campus somewhere. And it was a DEC computer, so I knew my way around it. I was playing around with it. And at the end, we'd finished playing with it, and we came out, and I was chatting to the lecturer and said, where's that DEC computer? He said, oh, that's in Harvard, in America. I said, well, you mean we dialed up? I was familiar with modems. I said, you dialed up to America? You know, how much did that cost? No, we've got something called the internet. I said, what's that? Wow. And so I went away, and of course, there was no internet to search it. So I kind of had to keep on hassling the lecturers. And then eventually I found out about TCP/IP, and I realized that was, which is the protocol on the internet, and we were looking at implementing that on our network. And then I realized, okay, so we can, my company was a global public company. We were in the UK, Los Angeles, and Tokyo. And we wanted to connect our computers together. We were faxing information between the computer centers, which sounds weird, but that was all that was available. We wanted to connect lease lines, but they were prohibitively expensive, like millions of dollars a year for to connect. And we were quite a large company, but you know, that's still a lot of money. And suddenly there was this internet that you could just pay a couple of $1,000 or $1,000 a month or something per site, connect to the internet, and you could use a public network to connect our computers together to get them to talk directly to each other for a significantly less amount of money. At that time, commercial traffic wasn't allowed on the public internet. It's like, oh, okay, that's a bit of a problem. We're a commercial company. We're sending, you know, orders and stock control lists and all sorts of things between computers. What do I do about this? So I was on a bulletin board, and there were three other guys on this bulletin board and said, we're lobbying the government to try and allow commercial traffic on the public internet. Business case, we want to start companies, but you actually have a use case. You actually want to use this internet for commercial traffic. Can we include you in this lobbying part and get you involved and sort of put your case to the government to convince them to pass legislation to allow commercial traffic on the internet? So I kind of joined in, gave the use case, and a few months later, the UK passed a bill saying, yes, commercial traffic was allowed on the public internet. So great. Cool. So I got an internet connection. So I connected our computer, contacted Japan and America. They said, no, we're not allowed. So, wow. Oh, screw that. So I suddenly had an internet connection ready to connect to our computers around the world. And I couldn't, because we were the only ones that could do it. So, wow. Okay, I really don't want to lose my internet connection. I love it. So I had to turn it commercial. And my colleagues had built into the original internet service providers, you know, dial-up internet service providers. The concept of starting a company that's never going to make money was an alien concept. You know, this is quite a modern thing. You know, you start a company, you generate a lot of, you obtain a lot of money, you acquire a customer base without making money. We were from a different era, different philosophy. You have to show you can make profit from day one, or see any commercial business model for an ISP making money. So I then realized, well, there was Tim Berners-Lee just created the World Wide Web, and we just built our first website and got our first inquiries. And I realized, okay, I can start writing websites for people. And so I started writing websites for companies. And then by 2001, we had a 45 megabit internet connection in both directions. It cost UK for 45 megabits, £15,000 per month. For a 45 megabit internet connection.
Wow.
And that was commercially viable, because at that time there was broadband was just coming out. Most people had dial-up modems, but we were making money. But and then so our cost base was something like 50,000 a month, and we were making money off a cost base of 50,000 a month. And we got sort of some of the very early customers, a very popular site in the UK called Friends Reunited. I went to school with one of the guys at Friends Reunited, and we hosted them, and they ended up taking 2-3% of entire UK traffic. We were dealing with KPMG, Andrew Lloyd Webber's really useful company. Sainsbury's, loads of companies that were just starting to get onto the internet, and we were hosting them and doing good business. And then we had a hostile takeover. So we got Peter Gillenhammer, who had sold his company Volvo to Ford, saw that we had land in Blackheath, which was a sports club, which he hoped to develop into houses and make a fortune. He didn't know there was a covenant on the land that prevented that from happening. So his firm successfully attempted a hostile takeover, only later to find out he couldn't ever do anything with the land. And so we kind of left. We lost that due to solicitor incompetence, as that we had control of the company, but our solicitors made a critical mistake. So we left the company, bought out all the small divisions. My internet company, they didn't allow me to buy out. That was sold off to another company. And so we left, helped those companies. They're now one of the companies we helped, a company called Quixent, now acquired my family's company, Densitron. And it now sits inside their company, which is a public company. So we helped about 12 companies. They kind of was mostly successful. And we exited the last of those in 2012. Then I started investing in Tech City in London and in China, in Shanghai. So my father opened up China in 1981 and went in there and started their journey to commercialism, along with he was on the first trade mission from the UK. And so we had a big factory there called VBest, which now Evervision we made. So the displays on your screen, we kind of started that business of full color liquid crystal displays. Technology called TFT, thin film transistor, was what Densitron kind of was involved in the very early days. Then I kind of took us into the internet era, and then we got booted out. kind of start investing in other technologies. And then 2016, I sort of bought Bitcoin. 2021, lockdown, saw the value of my Bitcoin holdings and thought, okay, this is for me. So that's a very abridged history of my working life.
Thank you for sharing, Mike. It's awesome. And I love speaking with people like yourself, because in some ways, as an investor, I can sit alongside all your experience and also buy Bitcoin. And I don't need to know, like, I can just ask you that one question. You can list off all of these things that you've been involved in, and you're interested in Bitcoin and you're putting your money into it. It's like, okay, well, actually, that's probably enough due diligence for me alone to be interested. And, and that's what I love so much about these conversations, because I'm able to, and anyone listening for that matter, is able to leverage your expertise and decision making for themselves. Mike, so 1989, and you were playing around with the internet for the first time. What are the similarities about, like, Bitcoin when you came across it and the internet at the very start? And, like, how far into Bitcoin's growth are we, do you think?
So, very similar. I'm seeing almost identical in terms of growth, adoption. You go through three phases. So you go through, in adoption of any new technology, you go through dismissal, ridicule, attack, accept, adopt. Okay. And we're somewhere between accept and adopt now on Bitcoin. But we've gone through the whole gamut of that with Bitcoin. You have to understand, in the mid 90s, most people said the internet would never work, and it's you and the internet's only ever used by criminals and pornographers. And that genuinely, the internet had that. And I was deep in the internet. You know, I was building websites, hosting websites, and everybody thought that the internet was only. Now, is that a familiar message with Bitcoin? You see that message with Bitcoin? There is a difference with the internet. The internet was a direct threat to middlemen. So it cuts out middle industries. Bitcoin cuts out governments. It's a different attack vector. So your enemies are different. With the internet, your enemies are all the knowledge industries that are trying to hold on to their domain, but they have power individually, but they don't have an awful lot of centralized power. They're not a massive attack vector. If you're trying to remove the control of currency from governments, that's a whole different attack vector. So Bitcoin has more powerful enemies, or had more powerful enemies, than the internet. So in that respect, It's a harder job, and it's going through more attack vectors than the internet did. But it's incredible. The journey's incredibly similar. And in fact, I argue on almost a daily basis, where in internet terms are we? And the consensus is we're somewhere between 1992 and 1997. In terms of number of adoption, we're at 1997. So there were about 300 million internet users in 1997. We're about that in terms of wallet addresses. So in pure numbers, it's similar. I would argue we're much earlier in Bitcoin because the sentiment is there. You know, we're still, so I tend to argue earlier, sort of 1994, something like that. But you can't draw exact parallels. So we're somewhere in the 90s in terms of Bitcoin adoption when you compare it to internet adoption. And bearing in mind broadband, the sort of ubiquitous, always on internet for a home user, didn't start happening till 2000, 2001. So we're still on dial-up modem for Bitcoin. If you put it, yeah. And I guess the analogy is, you know, my phone, I've got native wallets on here. When everybody's got a native Bitcoin wallet on their phone, we're probably going to hit the equivalent of broadband adoption. I think we're probably 5 years away from Bitcoin, the currency, ubiquitous currency. And I think it has to, why it hasn't taken off as a currency, apart from the attack, is it's high, it's going up, but it's highly volatile, and you don't want a volatile currency. So I think it has to sort of reach parity with gold and then potentially M1, M2 money supply. So it probably has to close to 100x to where we are now before it reaches its sort of full adoption and becomes a relatively stable currency, at which time people will be able to adopt it, because they won't be taking bets on the volatility of the currency. No, you know, volatile currency is a bad thing. Volatile asset is a brilliant thing. Volatility is fantastic for assets because you can buy the dip. But you don't want your spending power to be cut in half within a day. So we're probably 5 years away from Bitcoin, the currency, as a generally adopted currency. So the idea of Tether over Bitcoin is interesting in terms of it's a little bit like a hybrid car. You know, if you're going from petrol to electric, you may want a hybrid car first of all before you go full electric. So sort of Tether over Bitcoin is kind of like the hybrid car is today before you go full electric. Kind of how I see it.
Cool. In some ways, like, we're on the fringes of the internet talking about these things still. It's very true at the start of this conversation when we spoke about normie friends or people in your close community don't necessarily understand Bitcoin. And so here we are on video calls, you know, halfway around the world to have discussions or debates or conversations with people that seem to adopt things faster. So to me, when it comes to how early are we, I think you're right. We're very much still like in the early 90s in terms of the average Sunday lunch table is not talking about Bitcoin in a serious way yet. But it will eventually. And it seems to me the more I learn, the more inevitable it is. Mike, what I'd like to ask you is, at the start you mentioned that you run your own relay and that you have your own NIP. So can you talk to us about why you've decided to do that and how important it is?
Yeah, so I just got deeper. So obviously the power of Nostr is that you don't just own your own information because you're signing it, but you also own your own information because you can put it on your own relay in your own home or in a data center or whatever. Like Bitcoin, Nostr is a journey. So you start off and you download an app and everything's done for you. And then you realize that you can actually do things for yourself and you can take self-sovereignty. So I started off realizing that, so I was having difficulty uploading images on a client and I couldn't work out why I couldn't. And it was just the limits on the client, on the free option. And so I started looking around, and I started, and then I think it was the Fishcake. I saw him post about an update to Nosta Build. And so I looked at Nosta Build and I realized, oh, okay, so this is, and it suddenly occurred to me that on all social media platforms, you're uploading your image or content to a different server and you're just creating a link to it. But that what the reality is hidden from you. You just think on social media, you on traditional social media, you're just uploading your image and it's showing it for you. You're not. You're sending it off to a media server, and the social media platform is creating a behind the scenes link to show it in line, just like a web page. And because obviously I understand HTML, so I understood it's just a web link. And so I realized, okay, so social media's not been honest with us in terms of it, you know, the mechanics of how it works. And so suddenly I realized, okay, the mechanics are just like a web page. You know, it's just a link to an image. So I could load that image up onto like Google Cloud or Apple Cloud or something, but they're not native Nosta. Nosta Build was native Nosta. It's a media server. And I can also pay for it in Sats, pay as you go in Sats. So I'm gonna support this. Then I run my relays, and I have Umbral relays, and Umbral introduced, said, okay, we now have a relay that you can download, and you can point it to your own relay. So I installed Umbral's relay and pointed my client to it, and sure, it stored my messages. But my relays are on Tor, they're not on the ClearNet. It wasn't a public relay. It was just a backup relay for my data, but it didn't serve any particular purpose other than backing up my data. And I realized, okay, so what I really want is a ClearNet relay, but I don't want to make my Bitcoin nodes public facing. You know, I don't want to put them on the ClearNet. They carry liquidity, and that's not a good idea to put Bitcoin on the ClearNet. So then I looked around and I saw people were saying, "Oh, I've just got a relay from this provider." And it was Nosta1.com, and I checked it. It's Relay Tools, and I'm not sure who built it, but you could spin up your own sort of public relay very quickly, within seconds. And so I thought, okay, let's give this a go. So I span up a relay, and you have the options. You know, do you want to keep it private? Do you want to make it open? Or do you want to make it a paid relay? And so I said, okay, well, let's contribute. If I make it open, everybody will go on it. If I make it closed, then it's, what's the point? So I went for a paid relay, 2100 sats, and you can pay to use my relay, and it contributes towards my cost of running it. But it's actually a third party company. So now suddenly I'm running my own relay through a third party, and I store my own data on a public relay, and for anybody who interacts with me stores their data on my relay, and if you want to use my relay, you can pay it to store your own data. The next stage will be to probably spin up a Raspberry Pi or something like that with I think it's called StirFry. Is kind of probably my next project when I get around to it, to actually, and then create a ClearNet tunnel from Cloudflare or something like that, and to have my own administered relay in my own home on a ClearNet service, using probably Derek Ross's Web of Trust protocol, which I'm still getting my head around. So, but I like this idea of this self-sovereignty, and we are all each building our own infrastructure, and you choose what level you want to go to. Some people, if they just want to download an app and treat it like a Twitter style app and they don't get involved, that's fine. And then of course AlbiHub moved from where they were hosting sort of wallets into, okay, no, we're going to put it on top of your node, and you can run your own node. And so suddenly my existing Lightning nodes could suddenly take payments in from my Albi address. So mharcastle@getalbi.com, suddenly those payments were coming into my Lightning node, which was, again, and I could, by installing Lightning Hub, I could send payments in and out of my Lightning Hub. Then I realized, well, so I looked at Albie, and I discovered that the configuration file is just a JSON file, sits on their server. If you know where to point your web browser to, you can download your wallet, your Lightning address JSON profile. So I downloaded that, looked at it, realized I could edit this and put it on my own server. So instead of my Lightning address being at somebody else's domain, I could have my Lightning address being at my domain. So now you can zap me at my own address, mikehardcastle.com. And there's a file on my web server on a directory called .wellknown under my name, mike.json, I think it is. And that contains my Lightning profile, which is just a forwarding address. It just says forward it to my node. And it has some validation and identification criteria. And then I realized, we were talking about Twitter was talking about, or X, we're talking about getting verified accounts. And so Nosta plowed in and said, okay, get a Nosta verified account, 10,000 sats, and you can be verified on Nosta Plebs. And so I did that. I paid some sats to get verified on Nosta Plebs. Then I realized, okay, then I wanted to know what that was all about. So I then discovered it's just another JSON file on the server. So I downloaded that JSON file, realized how that worked, and realized I could verify myself on my own node. So I'm now self-verified, Mike at mikehardcastle.com, I just edited. So I'm not a coder, but I can understand code and I can sort of edit it and modify it so I can create my own copy. So I put a file called Mike on, I think it's the same directory, which contains my a hexadecimal conversion of my NPUB along with some other details. And that's stored on my web server, which means I'm verifying myself. So my identity is, so the great thing for me is my email address is mike at mikehardcastle.com. My Lightning address is mike at mikehardcastle.com and my identity is mike at mikehardcastle.com. They're all the same. I'm self-sovereign. I am what started off, in the late 80s as just an email address is now everything. It's my bank account and my ID. It's just one thing. And that very much appeals to me for some reason. So, I never understood the concept of why do you want to be verified at Nosta Plebs? It's like, I have no or any of these third party NIP verifiers. It's like, well, all that means I've just paid some money for them to create a JSON file for me. The true power of identity is me hosting my own identity on my own server that is me. A lot of Nosta Plebs are pseudo anonymous. So if you're anonymous, you absolutely don't want to be verified as you. but if you choose to be your real self, then, you want to be who you are. You can pay $10 a month to X, Twitter, and all you're proving is you're just paying $10 a month to X or Twitter.
It's like, which I am doing, sure, I've got credit annoyingly.
I did for a while, but I got a lot of criticism. So when Elon first took it over, I thought, okay, I'm fairly agnostic to Elon, but he's mostly doing good. So, okay, I'll support him for a bit. But the amount of abuse I got in the early days, like, okay, this is worth it. So I stopped paying my fees and didn't get the reach. I mean, I've never been a big social media. I've always used social media more as an information gathering. I've never been that bothered about telling anybody where I'm having my cup of coffee today. But
it's so cool. We're having this conversation now, right? I mean, it's very, very powerful being able to follow people online and just reach out. Like 30 years of experience building companies and products in the tech space, and you've jumped online with me and talked about why it's cool. I mean, it's incredibly powerful. You don't need to have thousands and thousands of followers to get value from it.
Yeah, and that's the point. I've been reasonably successful at orange pilling people in real life. I've been keeping a tally, and I'm up to about 30 so far, and that's one on one. And I'm incredibly sort of pleased with my real life tally count of 30. So having 2,000 or 3,000 followers on Nosta, it's not a huge number, but that's a hell of a lot more than 30. So, and even the even on my X account, I've got like 500-600 followers, something like that. That's still a lot more than 30. Now, they're not really paying much attention. I don't post much. They're not really paying much attention to what I'm doing. But, you know, even if I just occasionally post, and what I've been doing, I've decided to slightly go back to X purely to kind of get in the loop on what there are things happening outside Noster world. And I kind of do, I've been havering, which is a Scottish word for indecision. I've been havering with Odell's take on Noster only. And I kind of think, no, I still want to connect to the rest of the world. I still want to connect to the old world. And I'm not abandoning the old world. I'm kind of, you know, I'm happy to get my message and to sort of tell people who I am in the old world now. I've got enough confidence. I've probably been public as a Bitcoiner. I probably came out 2 years ago and said, okay, Bitcoin had got to enough level to say, okay, I'm prepared to go public. I'm prepared to tell the world. So it's on Facebook, it's on my Facebook profile, it's on X, Instagram. I'm a Bitcoiner. And for the last couple of years, that's, you know, on my profile, I'm a Bitcoiner. Here's my book. This is who I am. These are my articles. I'm a Bitcoiner. I'll defend it to death, you know. And I've got that kind of, it's got that level of acceptance that I'm prepared to do that. And I'm not prepared to leave the old world. You know, a lot of people say, screw them, leave them behind. They should know better. I'm of the view of, no, let's help them get onto a better way. You know, let's not abandon them. Let's help the normies find a better way. So I'm not massively active on centralized social media, but I am, what little I am, I'm now public about who I am and what I'm doing. And I have a, you know, very small reach, and I'm not trying to grow it, but it's authentic. You know, this is who I am. This is what I believe. This is what I'm doing. And if you want to listen, you can. And actually, it's interesting. So Facebook, I do put the occasional Bitcoin and Noster posts on when significant things happen. They get zero engagement, but especially on Facebook, I've literally, you know, I post about, you know, I've gone for a coffee down in Starbucks, 100 likes or whatever, but I post about, you know, Bitcoin ETF or Trump buying 1 million Bitcoin or whatever, zero engagement. However, I'd say probably a third of my Facebook friends have now DM'd me individually saying, can you tell me more about Bitcoin?
Yeah.
So they're all privately. And I'm now, the number of people I'm now orange pilling in secret on Facebook because they don't want to admit that they're interested.
Yeah,
so my Facebook Messenger account has a lot of activity on it because a lot of Facebook friends are saying, Mike, that Bitcoin you keep talking about, you know, I've seen this in the press. What's going on? Can you tell me? So yeah, sure. What do you want to know?
On the content we post, anything COVID related, vaccine related, it goes nowhere. Definitely, there's all sorts of censorship happening, and Bitcoin until last year, you couldn't add like Google ads, Facebook ads. You couldn't use them. They literally wouldn't let you pay for the word Bitcoin in their advertising. It's crazy. Well, I have to say, Mike, I've got probably another 10 questions. And if the internet connection was super solid, which is completely my fault, I'm sorry, I would crack on for another 2 hours or so. But that is all we have time for today. Thank you so much. If people want to reach out and get in touch, I assume they just email mike@mikehardcastle.com. What's the best way to reach out to you?
mikehardcastle.com, my website, or my NIP. So you can find me on Noster, Mike at Mike Hart. Everything. If you want to send me money, if you want to contact me, if you want to message me, everything's mike@mikehardcastle.com.
Awesome.
So,
well, Mike, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.